I don't know how you felt this morning when you woke up. Did you feel like, as you got out of bed, nice and early, or maybe not so early, that you could change the world? And if you were going to change the world, where would you start? How would you do it? If you were going to change the world, where in all the world would you start? Eric Clapton sang about it. If I could change the world, I'd be the sunlight in your universe. It's a love song. You would think my love was really something good. He's pretty confident there. If I could change your world, the world. Oxfam, at the moment, is having a campaign as well. Three things that you could do to change the world. The campaign wants to change my perspective and change the world through it by doing just three things. Amy from Wollongong is going to walk everywhere, stop using plastic bags, and op shop more. My wife, Beck, if she had three things that she wanted to do, op shopping would be on the top of her list. She loves op shopping. It's a great thing that she loves to do. Hakim would like to eliminate tribalism in his part of Uganda, to smile and greet his neighbours and promote friendship, and encourage girls to speak their Ming, whatever that means. I think he means speak their mind, if you can read that. Maybe, that just made me think of maybe one thing that we can all do to change the world is that as we type emails and type our text messages, we could actually check them before we send them and eliminate all the typos so we don't waste so much time trying to decipher what someone else is actually trying to tell us. The message from Oxfam is, if we can just change three little things, the world would change too. But you know, I wonder if the world really would change if I changed. Maybe you think the best way to change the world is to turn off your lights for an hour on Earth Day. Or like Amy, using green bags, green Coles bags, or Woolies bags for shopping. Or maybe only buying fair trade coffee or tea or chocolate. Maybe though, and I think this is what most people think. The way to change the world is to take a stand, is to stand up, to rise up. We saw it in Egypt and Libya, and now we're seeing it in Syria, in the Middle East, meeting tyranny head on by uprising with a promise of changing the world. But then I wonder if it really does, if you ask the average Egyptian, if you ask the average Libyan. This morning on Good Friday, we're going to look at two very different models on changing the world. It's a direct contrast. A choice made by the religious leaders at Jerusalem that we just read about as they're dealing with this person, Jesus. That's probably a picture of all of us as we think about how we would change the world. In the Middle East, the politics is complex. And it was the same back then as it is now. Jerusalem, that the story is setting, is under occupation. It has been for years. It's under the rule of the Roman Empire. The priests, those religious leaders, the teachers of the law, and Jewish people everywhere, they hated Roman rule. And so when you see them, as we did, and we'll see again in a moment, bringing Jesus before the Roman governor, as you see the story unfold, there's actually a story within the story. I want you to see that there's a hidden agenda and that their seeming respect for the Roman governor and their words, it's actually just hypocrisy. They're just weaseling. It's all part of this hidden choice that they're making about how they think that they'll change the world. It's a choice between two men on death row and what they represent, between the guy you heard, Barabbas, and Jesus, an insurrectionist and a resurrectionist. By the end of the story, one man goes free and one man goes to die. One man goes to fight for change his way and one man goes to a brutal execution on the cross. The night before, If we start with the story, the Bible verses will be up there. Night before, about 9:30, Jesus was betrayed in the garden. That's where we started in our reading. It's the Botanical Garden, beautiful part of Jerusalem. They came for him in force, the temple guards armed with their swords and clubs. It's hardly necessary, given that Jesus has been teaching openly in public places, in the temple courts, all week. But there they are, in the darkness. And as he's arrested, Jesus says in the passage there, in chapter 22, verse 52, "Am I leading a rebellion that you've come with swords and clubs?" And the answer, of course, is that he's not leading a rebellion. He's been raising the dead, not raising hell. He's been healing the sick. He's been preaching repentance before God and forgiveness of sins. But they arrest him anyway, and they take him to the upmarket house of the high priest. The soldiers, instead of just guarding Jesus, they mock him. They beat him, an innocent man who's not leading a rebellion at all. They taunt him to prophesy, "Tell us, who hit you?" and insult him any other way they could think of. Then at daybreak, on Good Friday morning, they bring him to trial. The elders and chief priests and teachers of the law, the Jewish elite, they're out of bed early. They're eager to sit in judgment on Jesus. And they throw questions, they hurl accusations at Jesus. "If you are the Christ, tell us." Verse 67, and Jesus says, "You wouldn't believe me if I told you. Are you then the Son of God?" And he replies, "You're right, I am." At which point they accuse him of blasphemy. And they lead him off to the Roman governor Pilate, whom, remember, they despise, they hate. But they take Jesus anyway and hand him over on trumped-up charges of sedition, of stirring up rebellion, dissension against the Roman authorities. And the irony is that, as we kind of come to this point, is that sticking it to the Romans is what everyone wants, except for Jesus. He's got a totally different idea about how to change the world. Everyone was all for an uprising. Everyone was for a rebellion, for sedition, except for Jesus. Yet he's the one that's been accused of that. The accusation is from the Jewish ruling classes to the Roman overlords. The accusation is, this man is stirring up trouble. They say, "We've found this man subverting our nation," chapter 23, verse 2. "He opposes payments of taxes to Caesar and claims to be Christ, a king." And Pilate asked him, "King of the Jews, true or not true?" "As you say," says Jesus. But Pilate somehow knows. He's a political animal. He knows something is up. He knows it's a beat up. Verse 5, they insist, "He stirs up people all over Judea," all over the region of Palestine, "by his teaching. He started up in Galilee and has come all the way down here to Jerusalem." So Pilate calls for a second opinion. The guy who actually is in authority over Galilee, Jesus' hometown, Herod, the Tetrarch of Galilee, was visiting at that time. It's kind of the holiday season. Everyone comes to town, to Jerusalem. And so he asks him for a second opinion. But the priests and the teachers, they're standing there, verse 10, vehemently accusing him of making trouble for the Romans, of leading a rebellion, of trying to change the world by opposing Roman taxes and claiming to be a king. But look at Pilate's words. Look at the judge's words as he delivers his preliminary conclusions. Verse 13, "You brought me this man as one who was inciting the people to rebellion. I've examined him, and he's not. I've examined him in your presence, and have found no basis for your charges against him, and neither has Herod. So, look, to make you happy, to keep you happy, I'll punish him, I'll flog him, and then I'll let him go." Now, here's the key. He's the turning point. He's the point where it becomes really, really clear what's going on here for all the religious authorities. This is a story on one level you could say is laced with irony, or maybe it's just full of hypocrisy. You see, the Jewish leaders accusing Jesus of inciting people to rebellion. It's not that they've got anything against rebellion. It's just a convenient excuse to get rid of him. Because with one voice they cry out in verse 16, away with this man, release Barabbas to us. Who's Barabbas? Well, there's a tradition, you see, at Passover time. That's kind of the time when our Good Friday and when our Easter weekend's kind of pegged to. That's why it changes every year. It's got to do with the moon. And at that time, a prisoner that the people can choose, anyone who's being locked up, could be set free. Okay? So who do they choose? Away with this man, they said. Away with Jesus. Release Barabbas to us instead. And the words in verse 19 give their whole game away. Barabbas has been doing time for an insurrection in the city, for rebellion, for sedition, and for murder. See that? That's their choice. You want to change the world? You can choose between Jesus or Barabbas. You choose between Jesus, who's not leading a rebellion, even though that's what they say is, or Barabbas, a convicted murderer who has been really leading a rebellion. But they want him anyway because they don't want Jesus. They're saying, declare Jesus guilty and set Barabbas free. Get rid of this Jesus change model and vote for the Barabbas model instead. Of violent protest, armed uprising, taking a stand. They're saying, we choose Barabbas. We choose insurrection as the way to change our world. And wanting to release Jesus, Pilate appeals to them again. But they kept shouting in verse 21, crucify Jesus, crucify him, crucify him. And for the third time, Pilate appeals to them. What crime has he committed? What's he done wrong? There's no insurrection here. There's no rebellion. It all seems to be going wrong, doesn't it? For innocent Jesus. But the fact is, it's actually all going absolutely according to plan. Because God's way, the Jesus way, was always going to involve death. A sacrificial death. And then resurrection. With loud shouts in verse 23, they insistently demanded that he be crucified. And their shouts prevailed. So Pilate decided to grant their demand. He released the man who'd been thrown into prison for insurrection and murder, the one that they asked for, and they surrendered, and he surrendered Jesus to their will. Now, just kind of, you might have noticed a little bit of a wordplay there, insurrection and resurrection. It's interesting, the original Greek word behind the word insurrection simply means to stand, to take a stand that involves standing up for yourself, standing up for your rights. And the original Greek word behind resurrection literally means standing again, having been laid down by death. So it's either an uprising kind of stand, or one who will die and stand and rise again. Which will it be? They take him to the place called the Skull Hill. They crucify him along with two other criminals. And as Jesus hangs there, taking his last breaths, as the rulers and the leaders of Israel sneer at him, they're laughing because a dying king can't save anyone. They say as they sneer at him, he saved others, let him save himself, if he is the Christ of God, the chosen one. And it's deeply ironic because the reality is, the real irony is the chosen one, Jesus, is actually choosing to suffer and die for his people. That the Christ of God, this chosen one, is giving himself up like a sacrificial lamb, the innocent for the guilty. There's a nice little YouTube video I came across. Have you ever done this thing where, as a little kid, you grab a magnifying glass, and which has this effect of, you know, in the broad sunlight, magnifies, concentrates the sun ray to a spot. And can burn stuff with it, like burn leaves or, you know, toy soldiers or ants, you know, if they're not fast enough. I saw this video on the web where this dude has taken the screen of a rear projection video, right, which does exactly the same thing. It's called a Fresnel lens if you want to look it up on YouTube. And but this magnifying glass is like this big, and he mounts it on this wooden frame. And, you know, takes it out the back, and, you know, Californian sunshine is, you know, comparable to our sun here. and he cooks eggs, he melts coins, and he does all that sort of funky stuff with this amazingly big magnifying glass that focuses the rays of the sun on a single point, on a single object. Friends, what Jesus is about to do as he goes to the cross, he's about to face a lens that is infinitely bigger than that, because what's about to happen is God's intense anger, his wrath, his judgment that we all deserve for our rebellion against him is all about to be concentrated by a big lens on the person of Jesus on the cross. On that cross, he doesn't just die as a man. He dies as a man under judgment for all of our sins. His death is a sacrificial death. That's what he's doing. And so one of the criminals who are hanging there beside him, he pours insults on him as well. "Aren't you the Christ? Save yourself and us." But the other criminal, he rebukes him, verse 40, and says, "Don't you fear God, since we're under the same sentence? We, he says, are punished justly, for we are getting what our deeds deserve. But this man, who has done nothing wrong, is dying innocently." And he turns to Jesus and he says, "Remember me when you come into your kingdom." He says to Jesus, "Remember me when you stand again. Remember me in the resurrection rather than the insurrection." It's interesting, isn't it? This whole account, there's one guy who gets it, and he's a criminal. Everyone else, in their plan to change the world, they think it's about power. It's about grabbing and seizing power, about using power, taking a stand with violence, power against power. There are two very clear models there, isn't there? Two leadership models: insurrection, all about power, or submission to death. Trusting God for resurrection. Two life models: taking a stand for yourself or putting self aside in the service of others. Friends, two things I want to kind of call you on to think about this Good Friday morning as you think about the way that you want to change your small part of the world is this. You see, Jesus came as a servant king, and that means two things. Firstly, and foremost, I want to ask, have you been served? Have you been served by the servant king? You see, the reason the king of the universe went along with it, the reason he placed himself under that massive magnifying glass to take the intense rays of all of God's judgment, the reason he allowed himself to be surrendered to the wills of those who were going to nail him to that cross, was his absolute confidence that it was all according to plan, that he was giving up his life as a ransom for many, that he was taking the punishment that he didn't deserve so that you and I can be forgiven. That's his great act of service to humanity. And yet maybe the insurrectionist, the rebel in your heart, just doesn't want to do that. And maybe you're saying, "No thanks, I'll go another way." Can I ask you this morning to change your mind on that? That you might think again with thanks. That you talk to God with thanks and say, "Sorry, I was wrong about that." And that is the first step in changing the world, by changing you and allowing the servant king to serve you. The second thing I want to call on you to think about this Good Friday, about how we would best change the world, is that the best way to do it is to learn from Jesus what it takes to change the world. And the simple answer is self-sacrifice. So many dads say to their little boys, "You've got to learn to stand up for yourself." Well, facing a schoolyard bully, that may be appropriate, that might be right. But you know, for most of us, if we think hard, if we reflect, that's actually not the recipe for how to live life. What we've got to learn is actually to serve the interests of others instead of just looking out for self. And if we all did that, it would be world-changing. Here's how the Apostle Paul puts it in Philippians chapter 2, another letter in the Bible. Do nothing out of selfish ambition or vain conceit, but in humility consider others better than yourselves. Each of you should look not only to your interests, but also to the interests of others. Your attitude should be the same as that of Christ Jesus, who being in very nature God, did not consider equality with God something to be grasped, but made himself nothing, taking the very nature of a servant. Even, Paul says, to the point of death on the cross. That's the message of Good Friday. Change the world by sacrificial service. Others first, us last. God will ultimately glorify that, as he did on that first Easter Sunday morning. What do you need to lay aside thinking about that? What battles do you need to step back from that you need to reconsider as you try to stand up for your rights? Or do you need to start serving sacrificially instead of insisting on your own rights? See, the funny thing is, Barabbas, the insurrectionist, many of us would have come here this morning and this would have been the first time we've heard of him in a long time. See, he's dead and gone. He's long gone and forgotten. But Jesus, the resurrectionist, he's still going strong, changing the world one life at a time.